From the studios of Wavefront Audiovisual Engineering in Schenectady, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, crime, greed, corruption, and all of the wonderful things that happen when you mix them together. Like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode 151 of Little Brother for the 29th of September, 2024. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. As always, I'd like to remind everyone that the opinions and views expressed in this program are strictly those of the participants and not necessarily those of anyone else who may, for whatever reason, attempt to claim them. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request an opportunity for a rebuttal. If you'd like an opportunity to join the conversation, you can write me at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com. Or you can post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. So let's get started. Not that I am going to defend driving at excessive speed, but I think it is safe to say that handing a driver a 7-digit fine is a bit excessive in and of itself. That's what happened to Connor Cato, who was ticketed for driving 90 miles an hour in a 55 zone in the city of Savannah, Georgia. The ticket that Cato was issued stated a fine of, get this, $1.4 million. Apparently, the excessive fine is set in the city's software as a placeholder and was not meant to actually appear on a ticket. It's there to cause city personnel to take manual action, which they apparently did not do, to ensure a court appearance for more egregious offenses such as driving 90 in a 55, rather than offering the motorist the opportunity to pay it and move on. The Detroit Free Press ran a story last week about a woman who was arrested and handcuffed in the city of Detroit in front of her 2-year-old son and had her car impounded for almost a year because of an error made by the city's automated license plate readers, or ALPR. It seems that her car was picked up going past a Project Greenlight camera a few blocks away from where a drive-by shooting had taken place. Evidence captured at the scene noted that the Dodge Charger used in the incident had a broken fog light. In testimony given 11 months later, it was learned that the police never bothered to check the fog light on her Dodge Charger, or they would have seen that it was in working order. And they also never checked for other evidence, such as, I don't know, gunshot residue. Needless to say, she is suing for compensation. Ghost, an encrypted chat platform, was infiltrated by police in 8 countries, plus Europol, plus Eurojust, leading to a bust of 51 suspects and counting. Now keep in mind, when using encrypted applications, if there is a server anywhere, there is always the possibility of an infiltration. UC Berkeley is in the news for a couple of disturbing things right now. For one, the battle between the cryptographic community and law enforcement is ongoing, and the FBI have partnered with the legendary home of the free speech movement to, monitor that free speech. In the interest of not repeating their mistakes of the past, they're seeking academic input to try to defeat strong crypto. I do hope that they understand that I do not wish them luck on that effort. The other reason that Berkeley is in the news is that they failed to disclose a $240 million joint tech venture with the city of Shenzhen, China. A deal like this would normally require registration with the U.S. government. A merger between Paramount Global and Skydance Media, under the corporate umbrella of National Amusements, Inc., has an interesting side effect. It seems that National Amusements, Inc. has a majority shareholder, none other than tech tycoon Larry Ellison of Oracle fame. Meanwhile, the combined corporate entities will control one of the major national broadcast news outlets in CBS. It remains to be seen how much influence Ellison will direct at the news outlet. However, it is worth noting that Ellison is known to be an election denier. While we are at it, I will also mention reporting from the Business Insider that Ellison is backing the use of his company's cloud AI software to monitor the activities of private citizens to keep us on our best behavior. Speaking of AI, internet infrastructure provider Cloudflare is offering some free tools to constrain the activities of AI on websites. The company claims that they have labeled all of the AI crawlers and figured out how to identify them, even when they are trying to mask themselves. That they are using aggregated information about the crawling activities to identify them, and most importantly, that they can block them. Speaking of things being blocked, as of Friday, Pornhub is blocked for users in Alabama. It seems as though the state has enacted a law requiring that users prove their age to access such sites, and that Pornhub have no good solution to implement a verifiable age check. Besides, simply blocking access better raises awareness amongst Alabamans who might choose to consider it when voting, even if they consider it very discreetly. Passwords are a pain in the ass, and the thing that makes them the greatest pain in the ass, though, are the rules. You must use at least one uppercase and at least one lowercase and at least one digit and at least one punctuation mark and at least one emoji. It must not be the same as any of your past 20 years worth of passwords. Cannot include your birthday. Must clearly indicate the current phase of the moon. Once you've set your new's password, it cannot be changed for 3 days, but it will expire in 4. Do not use a question mark, $/, / / or space. Thankfully, the National Institute of Standards and Technology has published new guidelines that get rid of most of this horseshit. If you can just get your organization to follow the newly published standards. And those are the headlines. You're listening to Little Brother. Here are the security alerts for this fortnight. I have one big one for you. CVE-2024-20017. This is a zero-click vulnerability affecting routers and smartphones using MediaTek Wi-Fi chipsets. In a nutshell, if you are using a router or a smartphone that has certain MediaTek chipsets, the device can be pwned wirelessly when it is acting as an AP by way of a buffer overflow leading to a remote code execution. No action is needed on your part for the exploit to be effective, and no security settings can disable it. The problem is in the MediaTek Soft AP driver bundle, and the fix, as is so often the case, is to patch your systems. Well, here we are again. It's time for another round of Who Got Pwned This Time. Now, this one is really not all that spectacular, but it's noteworthy because it looks like it's being handled right. The town of Ulster, in the mid-Hudson Valley, about halfway between Albany and New York City, got pwned, knocking out the town's computer systems. The town's security software detected the breach, the servers were immediately shut down, and the state's cybersecurity services were called in to help. Priority has been given to payroll and water billing services as the town has begun disaster recovery operations. In the meantime, manual procedures are being used to maintain day-to-day operations. And that, dear listeners, is how it's done. A software bill of materials, or SBOM as it is often called, according to Wikipedia, is a document that, quote, declares the inventory of components used to build a software artifact, including any open source and proprietary software components, end quote. Put simply, if you write a piece of software and it uses a library, you document that library in your SBOM. Ideally, that library should also have an SBOM, and so ultimately the entire stack could be traced out. Back in 2014, there was failed legislation called the Cyber Supply Chain Management and Transparency Act, which would have required SBOMs for any new products purchased by the federal government. While it did in itself fail, it also spawned some other projects, such as the Internet of Things Cybersecurity Improvement Act of 2017. The reason this is currently relevant, though, besides the fact that supply chains are going to be a major topic in this episode, is that the Army is set to require them for all new purchases starting next year without any ruling from above. Cloud services are, of course, exempted because cloud services, I guess, are always a problem. Anyway, once it takes effect, there is a 90-day deadline for them to publish a set of guidelines, including sample language, and this will help clarify and hopefully secure the Army's supply chain. Good job. Now do everything else. Continuing on our thought about supply chains, even though a lot of what might be said already has been said, I feel like I have to talk about what happened in Lebanon 2 weeks ago. For those of you who missed the story, how? Don't answer that. It's rhetorical. A day or two after last episode went live, some pagers exploded in Lebanon. The next day, some walkie-talkies did the same thing. Yes, pagers and walkie-talkies. To be clear, the use of these devices was clever on Hezbollah's part because they don't give up much, if any, location information, and choosing these devices in most case would be good OPSEC. The general appearance of it is that somewhere in the supply chain, an actor widely believed to be Israel, certainly somebody with state actor capabilities, although Israel has not said one way or the other, they took product from the supply chain, altered it without breaking its core functionality, and returned it to the supply chain to be delivered to Hezbollah. Now, before I proceed down this potentially very dangerous rabbit hole, this is a necessarily political topic, so let me make something perfectly clear. My sole loyalty on this conflict is with the civilians. I do not care whether they are Lebanese, Israeli, Palestinian, or Martian. If all you want is to be left in peace to work your job, care for your family, and raise your children, you have my alliance. So too, if you take up arms to defend your home. However, it's a very slippery slope. Once you get that involved, you can get overly passionate and lose your grounding. And this, I believe, is where we find Hezbollah and Hamas. Once that line has been crossed, fuck you, you're an asshole, and you're making the problem worse. So, with that out of the way, we could start by seeing what happened in Lebanon as clever. Okay, maybe it is. It appears that Hezbollah were the targets of the attack. I have got two problems with it. First, the attackers do not know where the pagers and other devices were when they were signaled to explode. Several civilians were injured, including children. Not acceptable. Since my loyalties, as I have already stated, lie with the civilians, the idea of so-called collateral damage, a term used to sanitize the accidental mass murder of civilians, is obviously abhorrent. Second, it means that we now have to scrutinize our supply chains much more closely than we have been. As a ham radio operator, do I dare buy a used walkie-talkie now? What about phones? Maybe they've infiltrated that supply chain too, and just haven't triggered it. Some folks have poo-pooed this latter idea, saying things like, oh, you're not in danger because you're not Hezbollah. What makes you think that whoever did this are the only ones doing it? Now, for what it's worth, I don't think Russia has a way to infect our supply chain or infest, whatever verb you want to use there. We don't really buy anything from there anyway, that or anything that was processed through there. Sometimes we get software from there, but that's, well, I'll talk about a little bit about that in a minute here in the next segment. But at the same time, I don't think China will do something exactly like this to the U.S. simply because of what China is. If you look at how China operates, look at how it's governed, look at how its decisions are made, China is a corporation. It's a manufacturing concern disguised as a nation. Fucking up the supply chain would be bad for business, and I think they're unlikely to do it, at least not with something explosive. I think, though, that the biggest takeaway from all of this is that supply chains are vulnerable. Sure, we're not likely to get exploding communications devices in our part of the world, but what if one fell off a truck? Then we might, but, you know, portable electronic devices can explode, so what else can they do? I have generally made it a rule not to platform shame people. Some folks use Linux, others use Windows, or a Mac. And you know what? That's okay. I mean, hell, I wrote this script using Linux running on a Mac. How fucked up is that? I apply the same logic to whatever. Musical tastes, brand of car, beer, phone, whatever. It's cool. My choices aren't perfect, and I made my decisions based on my criteria, so who am I to criticize? But I'm going to break that rule for just a second. And I'm going to ask everyone who was still using Kaspersky antivirus, why? From everything I've heard, Windows Defender is effective. And it already comes with your operating system if you're using Windows. So first, why spend the money? And secondly, why spend it on a Russian product? Can you trust that product? I don't know. I haven't done the forensic analysis to find out, and frankly, I really don't care. But I want you to think about what an antivirus does and how deep it is into your computer. In order to be effective, an antivirus must be able to read every file on your computer, all of them. In order to protect your computer from malicious files, it needs to also have sufficient privileges to move and delete files, so that they can be quarantined or eliminated. If it has any kind of active threat detection, it also needs to be able to sniff the traffic coming across your computer's network connection. In short, it needs to be root, or administrator, or whatever the god-level access is called on your platform. That's a lot of power to entrust to a third-party software. Can you trust them? Can it be abused? Well, we just got the answer. Let me explain how we got here. Then I'll tell you what happened. First off, back in June, Kaspersky got put on a U.S. government list of, quote, foreign individuals, companies, and organizations deemed a national security concern, end quote. Kaspersky made the business decision, based on this, to close all of their U.S. offices and to lay off the staff. In September, an email to the users indicated that users would continue to get reliable protection, even though software updates were no longer available. Then last week, we found out how that reliable protection was going to be delivered. An interesting thing happened. Users of Kaspersky found that the software had uninstalled itself and installed Ultra AV in its place. That is, of course, what you can do when a piece of software has God-level access to your system. It's one of the reasons why you want to only grant that privilege when it's absolutely needed. Unfortunately, as I already said, for antivirus packages, this level of access is indeed absolutely needed, and you are placing your system in the hands of the antivirus vendor. While I can understand the decision-making process that got us here, it's clear that this was a poor outcome. Essentially, Kaspersky have demonstrated clearly what they or another antivirus vendor could have done if they wanted to. Much like the Lebanese pager incident that I spoke of earlier in this podcast, though, actually going and doing it shakes the faith that people have in the supply chain and the products that it delivers that they used to trust. I've expressed a few times here that I have concerns about your devices snooping on your activities. Cars have been one of the most problematic devices since, unlike your cell phone, you kind of need it to get around. The alternative option of taking public transit, if it even exists, and if it even goes where you need it, only subjects you to more surveillance, as there are cameras and audio recorders on every bus and every train, and the trail left by the process of paying your fare makes it clear where you've been. I've probably not talked about cars enough. I'm incredibly pleased by the fact that I have managed, by buying a 7-year-old Ford, to find a vehicle that didn't have telematics in it. I did look up where the transceiver would typically be located in my model, and I was thrilled to find out that there's nothing there. Whether it was removed by a prior owner or just not used on this particular variation of this model, I don't know, and I don't really care. But I digress. The relentless collection of data by our cars has been weighing heavily on my mind, and so it is with great delight that I've learned that the government is actually starting to do something about it. Apparently, the Department of Commerce have stepped in and are proposing limits on the country of origin of certain integrated technologies, specifically limiting using tech from China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, and Cuba. The FCC have also stepped in with proposed rules to protect survivors of domestic abuse from being tracked and tormented via their vehicles. The FTC and some state agencies are also getting into the act about protecting drivers' privacy in general. This piecemeal approach could work in our favor or against us. On the one hand, it could leave gaps. That would be bad. But on the other hand, it could make the invasive practices of automakers so much more effort than they are worth. And this is something I will be keeping an eye on, and I'll let you know when I hear interesting things. On a related note, I've also often talked about automatic license plate readers. In fact, I talked about it in the headlines. I've included it in an interview with journalist Ethan Gregory Dodge, who's been closely following the developments of the technology and a company called Flock Security. You can hear that interview in episode 80 from a couple of years ago. Well, it seems as though there might finally be some traction on this issue. After the city of Norfolk, Virginia, installed a network of over 170 Flock Security ALPR cameras, they were used to try to solve a robbery. Doesn't this sound a lot like the headline? Sometime after the robbery of a video game store, a person was arrested for driving a car with a plate that was spotted in the vicinity. That driver, Javon Bell, challenged the warrantless collection of his information, and he got the court to suppress the evidence. The judge observed that there was similarity between the technique of using an ALPR to track a car and to attaching a tracking device to the car, something that has been beyond the pale since a 2012 Supreme Court case, U.S. versus Jones. The practical upshot of this is that this problem is starting to move. We may, hopefully, soon find these vast ALPR networks outlawed or severely regulated, and that would be a change for the better. As usual, we'll end the show with the fail of the fortnight. Have you ever gone looking for work and felt like your applications went into a black hole? What if I told you it was sometimes true? For over a decade now, HR departments have used computerized assistants to filter through the fire hose of applications that they receive. This is completely understandable. Applications can be filtered by various rules sets by the HR department to remove unqualified candidates, then prioritized by how well their CV or resume, whatever you want to call it, matches the job description. Simple Bayesian filtering, really. In theory, it seems like a good idea, and it seems to work well enough quite often. However, a story in the International Business Times highlights a case where the applicant tracking system, or ATS, was automatically rejecting all of the candidates for a job, even the qualified ones. That's not hyperbole. It literally rejected all of them, every single one. It seems as though a manager who was looking to hire some help was having no luck getting any applications from HR. The HR department kept telling them that they had not found any qualified candidates. Suspicious, the manager submitted their own CV, and it was instantly rejected. The manager. The email saying, "We've received your application," and the email saying, "Sorry, we're not interested in hiring you," literally arrived together. The problem, it seems, comes from a typographical error in the ATS. The manager was seeking an AngularJS developer, and the system was filtering out anyone who didn't have Angular 1, a similarly named but different framework. The system was rejecting all possible candidates. At the same time, the HR department was reporting that they had some candidates who hadn't passed the first screening. Well, of course they hadn't passed the first screening. They hadn't reached the first screening. Apparently, according to the story, most of the HR department were sacked. I wonder who conducted their exit interview. Little Brother is produced, recorded, edited, and hosted by yours truly, Chuck Ritter. Special thanks to Fungaboo and the Helix Foundation for web hosting support. Shout out to the Albany 2600 Group. Special thanks to Joe Cadillac, Julie Bernstein, David, Indecline, Azriel, Lotus, Knight Rider 007, Thriller at Play, and Fungaboo for story leads. Our headline music is Adrenochrome by Super Action 80. Our Who Got Punt music is Analog Summer 3 by Asarhad. Our Fail of the Fortnite music is Space Reggae by Zap. Our opening theme music and bumper is Around Chaos by Heatseeker, and our closing theme is Space Debris by Captain Image. If you have questions or comments about this podcast, or just want to join the conversation, please drop me an email at critter@littlebrotherpodcast.com or post a message on the blog at littlebrotherpodcast.com. Join us next time when Little Brother tells on Big Brother once again. Episode 152 will drop on the 13th of October. Stay safe and be well. It seems that her car was picked up going past a Project Green Light camera a few blocks away from where the drive-by shooting took place. Let's start this story over. In front of her two-year-old son, and I gotta get the fucking marbles out of my mouth. It might not be the same as any of your past... It must not be... UC Berkeley is in the news for a couple of disturbing things right now. That is not one of them.